Writing toward the end of his life, famed New York editor William Maxwell penned this fond remembrance of his aunt. He says this: "When I was a little boy of six, I met her, my aunt, on a cinder path at the Chautauqua grounds one day, and she opened her purse and took out a dime and gave it to me. 'I don't think my father would want me to take it,' I said. My father knew a spendthrift when he saw one, and hoping to teach me the value of money, he had put me on an allowance of 10 cents a week, with the understanding that when the 10 cents was gone, I was not to ask for more. Also, if possible, I was to save part of the 10 cents. "'It's perfectly all right,' Aunt Berth said. 'Don't worry. I'll explain it to him.' I took off for the place where they sold Cracker Jacks, and she stands forever on the cinder path at the Chautauqua grounds, smiling at the happiness she had just set free." Kent Hughes, in his Philippians sermon commentary, remarks that generosity is the singularly beautiful and, when remembered, will prompt a genial smile. This is what the latest example of the storied generosity of the Philippian church prompted in the imprisoned Paul in faraway Rome in prison. As we saw in the last study, he said in verse 10, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length your care for me has flourished." Here you have Paul sitting in prison, far removed by years, space, and time from the church that he loved so well, that he had given himself to sacrificially. And in prison, he is moved to smile by the generosity of these dear people. What is so special about Christian generosity? A lifestyle of abundant giving. It doesn't just bring a smile to those who receive the help or benefit, nor does it just bring a smile to the one opening his or her hands and doing the giving. Today, I want to challenge you with this thought: give abundantly because abundant giving glorifies God. Give abundantly because abundant giving glorifies God. Yes, it brings joy to those who receive the benefit. And yes, it brings joy to those who give. But give abundantly, not for your own benefit or for the benefit of those receiving, but give and give abundantly to the work of the Lord, because abundant giving glorifies a giving God. That is what we're looking at today. And of course, this morning it is fitting, right, that we consider the topic of giving, not just giving, but giving abundantly. As I mentioned last year, this is the time of the season of the cycle of life, each year to year, that we are looking at our budgets and we're evaluating the previous year and looking at the next year. We're making projections, we're setting goals, we're considering spending habits, good or bad, and we're really looking at these things. If you work in the accounting realm, you're doing a lot of accounting work right now as you're in your audit season. Some of you are working extra hours because of that. Numbers are a big deal to you right now, and these kind of things are important to consider. I find it ironic that this is the message we end up with today, knowing that we have our annual first quarter business meeting this afternoon as well. And sometimes I look at that and I say, I'll just move that around and preach on something that has nothing to do with the business meeting. But here we are. We're going to preach this message here today and let the Lord use it. The first point that we want to make this morning from this passage is that Paul commended the giving nature of the Philippian church. Paul commended the Philippian church's giving nature. He says in verse 14 of chapter 4 in Philippians, "Notwithstanding, you have well done that you did communicate with my affliction." Last week, we looked at the attitude that Paul had regarding finances and economic resources, and we found that Paul was content. Paul was able 1 year or 1 month or 1 week to have more resources. Paul also knew how to have not just the bare minimum required to live available to him. He also knew how to live with less than he needed and be content. If there was a meter on Paul's heart, if there was a way to check his financial contentment pulse, if he looked at his bank statement one week and had $1 million and looked at it the next week and had zero, his pulse would keep beating the same tempo. It wouldn't change. That's contentment. Contentment is not needing more or less. Why? Because if you have Jesus Christ, you have all that you need, even when you have nothing else. Jesus Christ, folks, is the only thing you need. And Paul realized that. And here the Philippian church is aware of his need while he's in prison, and they give to him, and he thanks them for that. He doesn't thank them in order to provoke more benefit for himself. He thanks them because he's appreciative. Let's talk a little bit more now, not just about Paul's attitude, which we looked at last week, but let's talk about the gift. I told you we would do that this week. Let's talk a little bit about the gift and the way that this church benefited Paul when he was in prison. It's a very helpful, practical, straightforward passage here. Philippians chapter 4, verses 15 and following, it says here, "Now you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel," when the gospel came to the city of Philippi for the first time is the idea, "when I departed from Macedonia, when I left you, no church communicated with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once and again unto my necessity." Letter A, the Philippian church assisted in his ministry after he departed from their city. They didn't stop assisting him after he left. Very clear, that's exactly what we're looking at here. When Paul planted the church at Philippi, and then he left Philippi, and he went to the next city and the next. And then when he left the region and went to another geographic region, not just another city, they continued to reach out in love and thankfulness and help to meet his needs. He didn't ask for that, but they did that because they were grateful for his sacrifice in their lives, and they wanted to continue to perpetuate that care and that provision to him in an appropriate way. And Paul wanted to note that. From the very inception of his ministry to the Philippian church, the people of that church reached out to him financially to provide for his needs. And we won't take the time today to see this, but if you turn back to Acts chapter 16, verses 12 through 40, you would see the account of Paul starting the church at Philippi. How that he wasn't planning to go there, and God put it on his heart through the Macedonian vision. He was not familiar with the territory. He was not familiar with the cultural setting. It was not the same environment as he was accustomed to. There was no synagogue. He had to adjust his methodology. He had to do several things out of his comfort zone to reach these people. There weren't very many Jewish men in the city, which he was accustomed to having. And the church started through a lady named Lydia. And this lady opened up her home then for the church to meet there. And then a jailer got saved. And you know the story of Paul and Silas being thrown into prison and being beaten and put in stocks and thrown into a dungeon cell. And they were praising God at midnight in spite of those unfortunate circumstances. And they left that city with a church there. And that church never got over that sacrifice. And they wanted to continue to be a help to him. Paul used the word communicate here. That's the word we have in our King James Bible. It does not mean, though, to talk or to converse. It's not referring to words in a speech balloon on a cartoon. What the word communicate is referring to here is the word that we looked at a while back in our Acts series. We talked about the matter of fellowship, continuing in fellowship. Fellowship being something we should keep doing and not stop. What is fellowship? It means to partner with someone or with one another, to actively participate with them, to share their experience. And frequently this involves giving towards a need or a cause as the form of partnership. From the very beginning of the ministry at Philippi, the believers viewed themselves as integral partners in Paul's ministry. Not by tagging along wherever he traveled, but by contributing financially wherever he traveled. That is the view that they took. That's what this passage says. It's very explicit. Max Anders, in his commentary on Philippians, says this, that Paul described the Philippians' relationship with him at that time in technical accounting terms. If you look at this passage, by the way, the verses we're looking at today are filled with technical accounting terms. This is a math passage. He uses accounting terminology. He's talking about money. No other church entered into a financial partnership with Paul. In a sense, the Philippian letter is, in fact, Paul's official receipt, acknowledging and giving credit for the church's gift to him. If there was an IRS back then, they would have clipped the church would have clipped this little portion of this out and submitted it to the IRS to get a tax write-off. Not really. But that's the idea. This is the little receipt of acknowledgement. Paul is saying, thank you for that and that and that. All these different times you've given, I'm recognizing that. I'm acknowledging that. My appreciation is deep. The frequent use of accounting and financial terms before us are fitting, especially considering the time of year that we're facing right now. While we're looking at this, let me also raise your attention to another aspect of financial talk here in this passage. This matter of partnership. Partnership in resources, what does that bring to mind? If you want to share in the experience of another, what about this matter of the stock market, right? When you invest money in a bank, you get very little back at this present time. I remember when I was in high school and I worked at a restaurant and I'd take my money from my paycheck and I'd tithe on that and I'd put the rest of my savings account towards my college bills that would come up someday. And I would put my money in the bank and I think I earned 1 or 2% on it in a simple savings account, which is pretty good. Today, that sounds like a lot. But then when I had enough built up after a year, I put that in a certificate of deposit, a CD, as you might call it. Still FDIC insured, so if something happened to the bank, the government said I would get my money back, if that means anything, but that's at least what they said. And so I would put my money in a CD, and I would commit that money to that bank for a particular period of time, and I couldn't touch it. But because I said they could have the money for a year and I wouldn't touch it, they gave me more interest rate. And I think I got, I don't remember exactly, I'm thinking it was as high as 6%. It was on the higher side. That sounds crazy now, and that's why I'm second-guessing myself, but I'm pretty sure that's the way it was back in 1995. And I'd lock it up, and at the end of the year, I would take that money, the CD would be open for about 10 days for changes to take place. I would take the money from my simple savings, and I would add that to the CD, and it was a small town. There were two banks, People's Bank and Owen County State Bank, and I'd look at their rates. And if the one rate was higher, I would pull my money out on a cashier's check and walk across the main street, put my money in that bank. And over time, I increased the amount of money that I had for college because I was saving and I was earning interest by partnering with the bank and all the myriads of mortgages and loans they were putting out. Now, all that money has since passed away. I think that happened about 2 or 3 years into college. It went back to zero. But there's something that we call the stock market, and the stock market is not FDIC insured. There's risk involved. Because you may not get the money back, but there are principles that play into this. And there is a time and a stage, perhaps, that you should consider putting some, not all, but some of your money into the stock market. And what is stock market investment? Very simple. It's a company saying, we want to take steps forward. We want to increase our worth, our value, and our profitability. We want to increase our presence in this economy. And so we need resources. And if you will partner with us and you will give us your resources, you will be a partner with us in this venture. We'll do the work. You just give the resources. And if our profits increase, yours will too. And there are different ways that those prophets come back to you. Folks, there's a better way than the stock market to invest in eternity. That is to invest your resources into the gospel ministry. And I'm not just talking spiritual religious talk to do it. I'm not just saying this to help us to increase in our giving. I'm not going to spend time today talking about the difference between tithing and sacrifice offerings, and that's not the purpose of the message today. If you're not tithing, you better stop and think about that, because that is very important. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. I'm just simply talking about giving as a way of life. You can put money into the stock market, and there may be a time and place for that in a certain degree. But everything, folks, everything you experience in this life that is not eternally related will mean nothing. The account will be wiped out, and it will be zero in eternity. But every dime that you invested in the gospel ministry cause will come back to you. There's no question about that. It will come back in multiplied form. And you get to keep that forever. And it honors Christ. We are not here alone to invest in the stock market. Well, we are here to be a pool of investors who pull the resources that God has placed into the accounts that have our names on them, though they really belong to Him. And we are here to make sure that those resources get plugged into the right gospel causes, so that someday there will be eternal rewards. Gospel ministry giving is like this. When you contribute financially to aid in the gospel ministry, as the gospel ministry bears fruit, you also will gain increased rewards at the judgment seat of Christ for eternity. We're not just saying here that what you give, you get back. What you give, you get back in multiplied form. But what you don't give, you don't even get back. It's multiplied returns or nothing. There's no middle ground. And simply today, I want to tantalize you. Yes, we're looking at our budget this afternoon and things of this nature. I don't know who gives what. I never intend to know who gives what. All I want to say is this. I'd love to tantalize all of us to give a little bit more to the gospel cause for one reason. Because it is an investment that bears eternal dividends. Letter B, this is a sad point. Letter B, Paul said that while the Philippians assisted in his ministry when he departed from their city, letter B, no other church did this. No other church did this. And that's surprising to me. The church at Thessalonica, the church at Berea, and then when he moved into Greece, out of the Macedonian region, he went to Corinth. And they didn't support him in Corinth either, and he spent a year and a half there. The other churches, one commentator says this, that the other churches failed in their obligations to the gospel. Paul called the Philippian support a matter of giving and receiving. Notice that in verse 15, he says, "No church communicated with me, fellowship, partnered financially, as concerning giving and receiving, but you only." When he stated that other churches did not support him, he used the common word for fellowship, which so characterizes this book. Subtly and without complaining, he pointed out, as a matter of fact, that others had received but had not given. They had a one-way relationship in the gospel. Glad to take, glad to benefit, glad to be the recipients of the Apostle Paul's ministry, but not considering participating with him in reverse to make sure that they did whatever they could so that the ways that he had benefited them would also be sure to benefit many others. for the sake of eternity. Partnering in the gospel ministry. As we consider giving financially to meet the needs of those laboring in gospel ministry, we do have to consider carefully our moral obligation to be sure that we especially partner with those who have given of themselves to us as a congregation. I think that's a very explicit application we have to draw from this passage. I don't see any other way around it. I think it's something we have to see. And yes, I think we can make a case for giving to all kinds of gospel causes, but if we're going to be honest to this passage, it is a very specific and pointed application. Whether this be former pastors or visiting evangelists or others who benefit this ministry in certain ways, this is something we have to conscientiously, personally evaluate. Do we want to be like the Philippian church or like the others who did not communicate as far as giving and receiving is concerned? Which will it be? And I thank the Lord for the giving nature of this church. This church has a testimony for that. And I want to thank you for that. But I don't want to be content. I would love to see that increase. Kent Hughes, in his commentary, says this, that when Paul left Philippi and traveled 95 miles down the Ignatian Way to Thessalonica, the poverty-stricken Philippians repeatedly sent representatives to Thessalonica with gifts to meet his needs. And when Paul left Macedonia, they remained the only church to support him. Even when Paul went to wealthy Corinth, from whose proud people Paul would not accept money, it was the Philippians of Macedonia who helped him. This poor church helped him to minister to a rich church. This persecuted church enabled him with resources to minister to an opulent church. What a paradox. The rich church was not the rich church spiritually. They had all the gifts. They had all the abilities. They had all the skills. And Paul said, but you don't have love. And if you have all these things and you don't have love, whatever you do is like a tinkling brass and a cymbal. It's like the clanging of pagan worship items. It has nothing to do with true worship of God. It is not giving like the rich who walked into the temple in front of Jesus and plopped in a few hundred dollars when they had millions to spare. It's like that widow who had 2 cents and she came in and she dropped in 2 cents. That is worship. That is what Jesus is honored by. My father pointed out to me as a missionary, I mean, 7.5 years ago, as he hit the road at 50 years of age and began to raise support to move to Johannesburg, South Africa. He said, "Son, I find it interesting, after a couple of years of traveling, I would have thought that the biggest churches would have been the ones that would have been giving the most. And I found that their gifts are generally very small." It's the smaller churches that surprise. It's the smaller churches that meet the need and sometimes in miraculous ways. It's the smaller churches, and I don't know where it comes from. He said it's humbling. May we be the kind of church that when a missionary or an evangelist comes through, they walk away saying, Faith Baptist is a special place. What a testimony. May we be the kind of church that displays not technical generosity, not just obedient giving, but abundant generosity to the servants of the gospel, especially those who minister to us directly. May God search our hearts. And may He take our fingers off of the resources that He has placed in those bank accounts that happen to have our names on them, and pry our fingers off so that He can do whatever He wants to do with those things, because they're His. Letter C. I think I've already alluded to this, but for sake of following the outline, note that not only were these people at the church of Philippi the only church that did this, they did this more than once. They didn't just do this once and then again later. They did this many times. This was a way of thinking and a way of practice for them. They didn't say, oh, we gave last time, we're not giving again. They did it again and again. That's what it says. At first glance, Paul's declaration that the Philippians were the only church that had fellowship with Paul in giving and receiving sounds like the cold language of commerce. Peter O'Brien says this, and indeed the words are technical accounting terms. However, in the context of the Greco-Roman culture, they are freighted with friendship. And here a warm and lasting friendship that recalls the mutual exchange of services and affliction which they had shared in the past through their partnership in the gospel from the first day. Thus, giving and receiving are idioms not just of cold financial terms, but of the deepest affection and friendship. Financial giving to meet the needs of those in gospel ministry forms a special personal mutual bond between the givers and the receivers, a bond that will last well into eternity. It's this kind of bond. It's the kind of bond that when the person who was on the front lines for the gospel full time, taking the hits, seeing people reached, seeing churches strengthened and started and multiplied, when they get the rewards, they don't just look at Jesus and thank Him for all of His goodness. But I can see those people looking over the shoulder to those who gave, thanking them as well and pointing them out. And then I can see those who gave standing and getting their rewards from Christ, and they are honoring, glorifying Him and casting their crowns at His feet, and then looking over their shoulder at the ones that they gave to and being so glad. And then those who were reached and those whose lives were changed, looking back at those who gave and those who served. And if those who were reached also were obedient in the faith, and they, some of them were serving and some of them were giving, those also, and you can see that this thing compounds, this is compounding interest. My father told me when I graduated from undergrad in college and starting my master's training, still single, still a bachelor, just enough money to pay for my bills and just a little more, he said, son, you need to start saving for retirement. Dad, I'm 24 years old. I'll do that later. I still have to get married. I still have to get a house, and I still have to have children, and I'll eventually think about that. Son, I'm telling you. I'm just saying. And so I took a little stash of money that I didn't have any plans for at the moment, and I said, oh, whatever, and I threw it into a 10-year CD. And I think it's making 7% or something. That's pretty good, right? That's going to be done here pretty soon, but I did not continue to add to it monthly. But I'm glad I made that decision. I can't touch the thing till I'm retired. And there's still not a lot in it. But it's more than it was. And recently my dad said again, son, this is about a year ago, I know things are tight, but you need to start thinking about saving for retirement. Oh, really, Dad? You thought I was tight then. Now I have a wife. Now I have kids. And at that time I had a house. And he said, just do it and set it on auto transfer so you don't have to think about it. And start small. Well, I got online and I did a little calculator. If you've never done this, I challenge you to do it. Just get out a calculator. They have these things online. And just calculate. If you put in $100 a month, you put $1,000 in some investment, maybe a mutual fund, you put it in. With good advice, you put in $100 a month and you do that for 10 years. That alone would surprise you how much you end up with after 10 years, and you probably won't miss the few times out to eat that you would have had to skip for that. You also have a little bit of assurance that your wife might be taken care of a little better if she gets placed into some special medical care. But also, the compounding interest. I'm not going to say any more. But the power of compounding interest over time is incredible. And so I took his advice. And it's just a little bit every month. And I have a million other things I could be doing with that, but I don't think about it and it just goes there. Folks, that is just a microscopic illustration of the kind of return spiritually that you get in eternity when you give to the gospel cause. It compounds. And I would challenge you, do an online calculation about what I just talked about, and then stop and apply that principle, because you will be blown away. Apply that principle to spiritual giving, and you'll realize there is good sense to giving to the gospel cause. Eternity is a long time to live with your investments. Number two, Paul urged them to continue giving with God in mind. And that's what I've just been doing, right? I just started to do that. So let's move on to the second point. He urged them to continue giving with God in mind. He says, not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. Paul is encouraging them to continue their testimony of being abundant givers, to not back away, to continue doing this. You see, abundant giving is not a get-rich-quick strategy. It's not this prosperity gospel idea that if you plop $100 on the plate and you buy your pastor a fancy Cadillac, you'll be blessed. That's not at all what we're doing here today. I've seen that. I've heard of this. When I lived in Milwaukee, I saw this far too much. What I'm talking about here today is not also a sterile financial principle of sound fiscal management, where I'm urging you to give because it makes sense and it's the principle of the matter. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about this. Abundant giving is the result of a perspective that considers God above everything else. And that's what I'm asking you to do today. With regard to your finances and regard to your giving habits, I'm asking you to consider God above everything else. Letter A, Paul was not seeking his own benefit. And that's the awkward thing here for me. Church leadership and gospel ministry can be a unique challenge on this point. For me to stand up here asking for support or challenging a church to give is awkward. And to give more abundantly, this can easily affect the motives of the preacher. You think I'm aware of that? I am. I'm very sensitive about that. I don't like doing it. I don't want to be motivated by money. And I want all of us to be motivated by God. I want this to be a giving church. I want this to be a church that gives over the top, that gives to the point where people think we're crazy, because that's the kind of giving that opens the door for miracles. It may not open the door for riches for us in our bank accounts. We may get more poor, but there will be spiritual repercussions that the next generation will face. I didn't know the giving at my previous church. But the deacons remarked at times, without giving names to my pastor, that those who were regular in their tithe and those who did not hold back and continued faithfully in their giving had more success with their kids. And those who didn't, there were times the deacons would say when a family was struggling with their kids, not that particular family in particular, but they would just make the comment at times, there are times that we're just not surprised. We could have guessed. Because there were some people that just hadn't been giving. They backed off. They stopped. God blesses givers. And it's not just it's necessarily in money, it's in faith. If you can't believe God to give to God, what can you believe him for? You live with a guilty conscience. You live robbing him. You're a thief. And there's very little you can do about it until you get honest about that. This is between us and God. Paul is not seeking his own benefit. Greed and discontent can easily creep into the minister's heart and motives. to be sure meeting the needs of those who minister the gospel in a full-time capacity, though, it is the right thing to do and to do well. 1 Timothy 5:17-18, Paul says, "Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. For the scripture says, 'Thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treads out the corn,' and the laborer is worthy of his reward." Do you sense with me the spiritual quandary that I have to talk about this? It's extremely awkward, but it's important. Because it has nothing to do with the gospel minister. It has everything to do with your response to God. That's what it has to do with. It is our responsibility as a church to seriously consider what the Bible says about abundant giving, not just to meet the needs of those who serve here in an ongoing way, but those also who do so temporarily or have done so in the past. What motivated Paul to urge the Philippians to continue giving generously? Let me give you a hint. It had nothing to do with a comfy retirement for him. Nothing. And what I'm telling you today has nothing to do with that for me either. I'll tell you what it has to do with. He's very clear. Verse 17. "Not because I desire a gift." There's too much preaching that desires a gift. "But I desire fruit that may abound to your account. Because I have all and I abound. I am full. I received your gift from Epaphroditus." This is my paraphrase here. "And the things that you sent, they were an odor, a sweet-smelling sacrifice acceptable to God. I'm doing fine. I'm talking to you now. Not that I would increase financially, but that you would increase eternally. Don't stop. And don't stop just because my need is met. Continue to look for ways to give. There's always another way. There's always another opportunity. There's always someone, something that needs that support for the gospel cause. Don't ever stop and turn off the faucet. Because I desire a gift." Folks, I think about this a lot. I think about you standing before the judgment seat. And I want it to be a wonderful time. I want it to be an over-the-top time. I want when the members of Faith Baptist Church stand before God, I want that to be a special moment that is etched in the archives of eternity. I want it to be a time where we demonstrate that real New Testament Bible Christianity was possible in this century, in this country, in this city, not just in some third world impoverished nation. I want to demonstrate to all of eternity that it was possible here and now as well, in opulent America, where very few of us really have needs. It's hard to be generous in an opulent nation. It's hard to be generous in a prosperous economy. It's hard to be generous when the government tells you you're in poverty and your refrigerator is full. It's hard when we have this entitlement perspective that we deserve so many things. The only thing we deserve is hell, folks. And the only reason we're not going there is because Jesus didn't just give resources, and he does that all the time. Every penny that goes to your account is a gift from God. He's a spendthrift when it comes to you. He gave his life. He's not telling you to do that quite yet. He may call on some of us. But folks, your kids will not have the guts or the faith to be a martyr for Christ if mom and dad couldn't tithe. If mom and dad couldn't give to a missionary. If mom and dad didn't have the faith to use their money right, they're not going to have the faith any better than their parents. The word abound conveys the idea of compounding interest. We've talked about that. Do the math on the internet. Find a calculator that does that. And then apply it spiritually. If we are part of a missions-focused church, we may imagine we're just fine. But the call to give to reach the world has not gripped our souls unless we ourselves, individually, are giving sacrificially to that end. You may come to church. You may be at church on a somewhat regular basis. But if you're not giving, you're not really serving. And you're not really in a place of spiritual contribution. I tell you, the people who are giving sacrificially, obediently, and faithfully, without excuses, God is using them beyond that, because they have faith. Where their heart is, that is where their treasure is. It's in the work of God. Have you been convinced to scale back some personal comforts and your financial management? Have you been convinced in your personal financial strategy and so forth to contribute even more significantly to the cause of Christ, the kingdom of God, and the spread of the gospel? Folks, it's worth it. Boy, is it worth it. Your retirement pleasure trips will mean so little at the judgment seat. You're going to have a whole new heaven and new earth to explore without visas and without plane tickets. You'll enjoy that all someday. It's not wrong to experience those things now. But could I tantalize you with what's on the other side and cause us to live for that? Could we go above and beyond? Could we live for eternity, really and truly? Here in opulent America, I know we're scraping here at Faith. We're surviving in this city. It's tight. It's a challenge. It's a fun challenge. Eternity is so more real, though, folks. Matthew 6, 19 through 20 says, "Lay up not for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt." Now, let me just say, it is wise to save ahead to meet future needs. I'm not talking about that. When we talk about laying up treasures, we're not talking about having any account with a lot of money in it. That's not sin. What I'm talking about is piling up treasures for opulent comfort and things that really are not necessary. It is right for me to save to make sure that my wife is properly taken care of, and the costs of that are high at old age. That's right. I don't need a Cadillac. And I don't need to go to the Caribbean every other month. That is unnecessary. It's not wrong. But I want to live for other things. And I want to challenge all of us to think that way. To lower perhaps our standard of living and increase our standard of giving for the cause of an eternal lifestyle that will never pass away. That is able to look at Christ, because we will look at Him every day of our life in eternity, and not regret how little we gave. To look at Him and realize that, yes, to the best of my ability and by God's grace, I gave equal to the gift that He gave to me in some degree. You're going to look at Him every day of eternity. Will you be able to say you responded with equal grace as much as you can? Giving opens up your vision. Here's a little poem by a man here, I think named Leland Ryken. He said this: "My barn burned down last night. Now I can see the moon." And sometimes it takes us giving away those things that are blocking our vision of God. God, number two, God meets the needs of those who give abundantly. Did I give point one, subpoint one there? Abundant giving pleases God. Abundant giving pleases God. It's a sweet-smelling sacrifice. It's an odor well-pleasing to God. I wouldn't stand here and tell you to give, folks, if it didn't say this. But it is. We don't go to the temple and offer sacrifices of animals. But when you put that money in the offering plate, it's a sweet-smelling savor to God. It's an act of faith. And to not do it is an act of defiant unbelief. I think I can say that. The idea here is that God is, that we sacrificially, as we meet, as we give sacrificially to meet the required needs of gospel cause, God Himself will see that our own required needs are met. There is no hint, though, that a prosperity gospel is being taught here. The point here is not that you give a lot and God will pour more money into your accounts. He may do that, but that's not why we do it. He may not do that. That's not the point. In fact, giving may cause a need. You may find yourself a little short financially if you give the way He wants you to. And what is the promise that we have on that point? My God shall supply all your need according to His riches and glory by Christ Jesus. If you find yourself tight because you gave above and beyond, be ready for a miracle. If you only give what you think you can give, or you don't even give obediently, expect no miracles. Expect to have to figure it out on your own. I don't know about you, I want my kids to see miracles in the Overmiller house. And my faith needs challenged even more on this point. Because we need to see more miracles than we have. I've seen miracles. But I want to see more. And giving causes me to need them sometimes. But they're fun to see. Which is more fun? Which gives more glory to God? Being able to explain to your kids how you, through your wisdom, met the needs of your family? Or sharing with your kids how you took a step of faith and God did a miracle? Which puts the attention in the right place? The attention needs to go to God, which is the last point. God is glorified, number three. Abundant giving glorifies God. Let me make this statement here. The stunning scope of the promise, one man says, is that there is not only one thing that a faithful, giving Christian truly needed that God would not give, especially when the need was caused by giving. On the basis of this, we can proclaim to every generous believer that God will meet every need he or she has. But to the grudging, there is no such solace. The wholesale application of this great promise does not exist. It is for the generous followers of Christ alone, whose giving glorifies God. Does your giving at all look like Jesus going to the cross? That's the kind of giving that glorifies God. The measured, careful kind of giving, that looks nothing like Jesus going to the cross. It is not the way God gives. God gives lavishly. God gives freely. God gives mercifully when it is not deserved. Does your giving look like that? Or are you the, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to use this. I know it's a literary piece and it's not the Bible. Are you a Scrooge? Are you a Scrooge? Or are you a spendthrift for the gospel? You will not be called into judgment for merciful, gracious, opulent giving. You will not. You will be honored. That person who is tight for the gospel will get a tight reward at the judgment seat. It will be almost nothing, if anything, and it will be a sad, quiet moment. This afternoon, of course, we're going to have a budget presentation for our members. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? I'm going to give you a calendar of the major events for this coming year. Thrilled by how God has put some pieces together. It's taken a lot of time and effort to seek the Lord and to put this together. But even then, I know so very little about this coming year. This calendar may look nothing like what I give out to you. So many things could change. But I know one thing. If we will be a church committed to the cause of Christ, He will meet every need that we end up having because of that. If you are considering becoming a member of Faith Baptist, let me strongly urge you to take that step of partnership now on the front end of this year. talk to me. Let's explore that, because you need to get plugged into the gospel cause, and you need to do it soon. If you are a member, let me encourage you to give faithfully, obediently, and opulently, sacrificially to the cause of Christ through our body this year. To this degree, to the degree that we give, will be, I know this for a fact, it will be the degree that we experience the provision of God for every need. We look at this budget this afternoon, I think it's a careful budget. But I don't want just a careful budget. I want a budget that expects miracles. I want a budget that's as big as God. And if you're a sacrificial, opulent giver and you have a question about the budget, raise your hand and let us know. But if you have no intention of meeting the need, let me encourage you. Don't say anything. Sit back and let those who are ready to take a step of faith step across the line and watch what God does. 2015 may be a terrible year for the American economy. You know, I've heard different people say about budgets and their church finances, oh, it's been a rough year economically. Amen. What a chance of a lifetime to see some miracles. That's what I say. Faith Baptist needs to be a supernatural place, not a penny-pinching place. And I'm a careful person, understand what I'm saying. William Howe said in this poem, "We give thee but thine own, whate'er that gift may be. All that we have is thine alone, a trust, O Lord, from thee." Let me close with this thought. It says in verse 20, "My God shall supply all your need." But verse 20, "Now unto God," and look what he throws in there, "and our Father." And if you translated this in a certain way, what he really is saying here, when you understand the Greek words, is, "But unto God, even our Father." He's not just a God that we owe some debt to, that we have to pay up to. No, He is our Dad. He's our Daddy. He's our Father. I want to say one thing. I have a Dad who took good care of me. And in the future, if He has a need, I want to take care of Him. If I have to, I want to put a room in my house for Him. I want to do whatever I have to do for my dad in the future, because as I'm a dad now, I'm beginning to understand what he sacrificed for me. And when I'm talking to you about giving, I don't speak in respect of one. I've been here 6 months, folks, and you've taken good care of me. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about God, our Father, needs our best this year. Let's open up our hearts in this matter of giving, and let's look for miracles. Let's pray.